Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking social justice with a twist. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man who actually, lads, we were supposed to do this like an hour ago, but Martin's finally figured out how to use his dial-up internet to get here. Martin, what's the story, buddy?
Yeah, we're a bit abandoned out here in Ashburn. We keep dropping in and out, so we have to use alternative methods of getting internet. I have a gerbil on the wheel, so it should keep going for a while.
Speaking of a gerbil on the wheel, we're in a position now at the moment where we're doing these live shows, we're putting them out, people are enjoying them, but I have to tell you, I'm getting hit with all sorts of extra costs that I wasn't anticipating in terms of webinars and hosting and all the rest of it. Folks, we need a bit of support. Put your hands in your pockets. Price for a cup of coffee. I think what we're doing is making a difference. I think people are enjoying it, but it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And you know, just give us that little bit of a push, and we will try to keep bringing you these. Anyway, enough of the self pity. Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack via Zoom by research and policy analyst with Social Justice Ireland, self-proclaimed nerd Colette Bennett. Colette, how are you first and foremost?
I'm wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Tony, and yourselves. Oh. Hey, Martin.
How are you doing, Colette? How are you?
Wonderful.
Listen, I suppose, look, we've spoken before. We've been at several conferences and we've bumped into each other. And you are a big personality. You know, you're about 5'6", but you're a big personality, you know.
You've given me 5 inches, so thanks.
You're taller than Martin, look. but nonetheless, when you're going into these things now, at the moment, it has to be a big challenge for us to talk to one another about what mattered pre-COVID and what matters now post-COVID, you know, because are the issues just more exacerbated now in your eyes?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't see that kind of a delineation, really. I think what COVID did was highlight all of the issues that we've been talking about for years. Mm. So, you know, things like housing, the whole fact that people could not socially distance because they've been in cramped conditions, because, you know, things like direct provision have been causing problems for years. Things like emergency accommodation was never a good idea. Like the hubs, never a good idea. You know, the lack of domestic violence refuges, the lack of safe spaces for people, you know, traveller accommodation has been an absolute disgrace for years, down to things like overcrowding. So this just highlighted all of that. The same with the healthcare system. You know, we've been talking about the fact that at 95% capacity, the acute services just cannot take any more strain. We need to start bringing in primary care networks. We need to start seeing more primary care health teams in the communities for a range of things, you know, from older people, from people with disabilities. You know, we need all of that. And again, we've seen where when there's a pinch point, when a crisis happens like this, and no one could have expected this, but it's only served to highlight what the difficulties are. It's only served to highlight, you know, things like precarious employment and low pay. Like even with, you know, a full or almost full employment back as far back as February, if we can remember that, you know, we still had 110,000 people below the poverty line in work. You know, so that kind of stuff, we're now seeing, you know, this huge unemployment rate. But that was always going to happen. That was just waiting there for something like this. So I don't think that there are necessarily different challenges. I just think it's just highlighted how bad things were.
I think that's a really great summary, actually. I really think that it's just exacerbated, exposed, and put in full scope things that people like yourself have been saying for years.
Absolutely.
And I want to come back to one of the things, and it's a quote from you, so I'm going to quote it back to you. It's that when the government's main plan for housing and homelessness was the much maligned and failed, in my opinion, Rebuilding Ireland plan. And you said that the policy for public housing is pretty private. And I thought that was a brilliant summary of it, because it what it meant was, in essence, that they still, even though we saw these pillars and all these numbers look very impressive, it was purely a private-driven model. Is that fair?
You completely froze there. I didn't hear a thing.
Sorry, I'll go again. So what when we looked at, when you look at Rebuilding Ireland, the actual entire numbers look good, the plan looks good, it reads kind of cool, but the actual, am I gone again?
No, you're not gone. I'm just shaking my head because it doesn't, I don't even think it does that much.
Sorry, Martin is moving as well. But going back, so we go for a third time. When we look at Rebuilding Ireland, it had all these figures, it had all these numbers, all these ambitions, these pillars that were going to be done, and they looked fairly impressive on paper, but they certainly added up to just a private model that was going to force through with a few crumbs to the table from the public.
Yeah. I mean, we went through it. I presented a paper at our conference last November going through Rebuilding Ireland and just having a look from the perspective of, you know, younger people and families and older people, because that was kind of the theme of our conference, was on demographics. And under every single pillar, there was both a failure, there was an over-reliance on privatization and financialization, and there was a complete, to borrow somebody else's term, obfuscation of the data. So there had been a European study, commissioned by the European Commission. Mary Daly did it last year. And it talked about the homelessness data. And it was saying, you know, it amounts to obfuscation, if not corruption. Hmm. And that's throughout the housing data. You know, there wasn't one data set that you looked at that you thought, that's actually accurate. Like, you look at the homeless data and it's only based on emergency accommodation. It's not based on what the local authorities were calling emergency accommodation, where people are temporarily accommodated in local authority owned own door accommodation. Mm. So there's families missing out of that. It obviously doesn't account for people living with their friends and their families and couch surfing. It doesn't include the rough sleepers. You know, there's a whole group of people that are missing just from that set. And that's pillar one. You know, then you start looking at social housing. Social housing is missing thousands, tens of thousands of households. So if you're relying on, I think it's in and around the 69,000 now, you're missing out the HAP figures. Because when the housing assistance payment came in, that was seen as a social housing solution. And that's a sure sign of both the privatization and the financialization of public housing. Because all that is a landlord subsidy. And it's tied into market rate. We're throwing money at that for nothing.
And there's been a 350% increase in the number of homeless families since 2014. How can we justify ever going back to that?
We can't. I mean, fundamentally, we can't justify that. We could never justify that. We could never justify family homelessness. And that came about in real terms, I suppose, as a result of the last economic crash. So, you know, when it was a case of the financial system just collapsed, then, you know, everybody ran for the hills. The mortgage that the banks ran for the hills. And like, I worked in debt advice, debt support around that time. And to try and engage on people's behalf, the lenders initially just didn't believe it. They just didn't believe that people were in the kind of trouble that they were in. And like, we had people, you know, self-employed, people who had previously had pretty good jobs, and all of that had fallen to the wall. We were sold an absolute pup on the way up to the financial crisis in terms of, you know, 100% mortgages, dual earners, get your foot on the ladder and go bigger, go bigger, go bigger again. And, you know, this idea that that's what social mobility is, which it absolutely isn't. And then when the crash happened, somehow it was the individual's fault. Somehow it was the borrower's fault. When this entire policy, and, you know, that's something that I'm very passionate about in terms of the work that I do. You know, every single thing, that every decision that we make, everything that we do is based on a policy or is affected by a policy. You can't buy a loaf of bread without it having been subject to, you know, at least you know, five or six different types of policy, from what's in it to how it's advertised to how much it costs. So, you know, when the last crisis hit, this was just something that we were very, very slow as a country to tackle the fact that there was a mortgage crisis, that there was going to be an issue with people paying their rents, and that there was going to be large-scale homelessness. And we're still looking at 1,500, like nigh on 1,500 families as of last March accessing emergency accommodation.
And the model of taking care of the elderly, which you've mentioned previously, is predicated on home ownership, in that when you get to nursing home level, it's actually your home that pays for it. And we heard Paul Reid yesterday saying that we are going to have to look at a different model to congregated settings for elderly people. So that looks like we're going to have to look at a different model altogether of funding it. And they have mentioned this as well. It can't be based on home ownership going forward, because home ownership is dropping so fast, the numbers. So where is the solution?
Well, there's a couple of things on that. I suppose the housing model for older people just isn't functioning. So it's either you have your own home, or you're in a nursing home or a hospital waiting to get in. You know, the amount of delayed discharges, for example, that's because there isn't step-down facilities. There isn't enough supports, again, within the community to let people age well in their own home. So we need to look at, like, back in 2016, and I think Rory Hearn was involved in it, there was a housing agency report done that looked at a spectrum of housing supports for people, for older people. But if we took that spectrum and looked at, well, how do we develop housing for the community? How do we develop housing where you grow up in your family home, you go out to work somewhere local, you might get, like as Orla Hegarty would kind of advocate for, you might get a flat over the shop somewhere that's kind of in the town, in the city, you're living your young, vibrant life, you want to have kids, there's an affordable housing within your reach, and it's family home based. It's not this kind of step on the ladder to go on to something else. And then, you know, as you age, as your children leave home, if you want to, and you want to, which is, and that's the fundamental thing, is the choice element of it. If you want to move on and right size, as it's called, your home, and you want to move into something a bit smaller, then that should be somewhere within your local community where you've built those relationships. And it's crucially important, and you can see it even now, it's so crucially important to older people to have that network. Because if, like, I live in rural Ireland now, and if you live remotely, you know, if you're not near your family or extended family, it can be very, very difficult to get the basic things done. And, you know, that's not even talking about having any specific health needs. That's just getting your shopping. So that's one element of it. The other, in terms of like what's going to happen into the future. So, yeah, traditionally, you're talking about 80-odd into 90, depending on how old you get, percent of people will be homeowners outright, kind of that older age bracket. So you're talking 65 plus. By the time you're kind of in your 80s, it goes up again. But as you rightly point out, you know, we are becoming a nation of renters. We cannot save. If you can't, like, if you're paying 2,000, 2,500 in rent, you've got very, very little to save for anything even remotely like a deposit.
I think Lorcan Sir points out that we've jumped two generations in the space of a decade in terms of our movement on any demographics from homeowners to renter markets. So sorry for interrupting you, but just to put it in context.
No, absolutely. But then there becomes a policy discussion that is absolutely, absolutely desperately needed, which is, well, where does the money go? What are we looking at here? Are we looking at the provision of sustainable long-term housing? Or are we looking at supplementing the pension pot? Because as you age, if your income falls, and there were some studies done by the SRI, and it talks about income replacement rates after retirement. It was based on the Tilda studies from Trinity. And you're talking like anywhere from, you know, 99% for the lower income brackets, they get to retain about 99% because their income is low. So when they go on to the pension, you know, it's not that much of a difference, if it's a difference at all. Hmm. And then you've got like 50% for those on higher incomes. If you're earning a higher income at 64, or 65 or 66, depending on the retirement age, and you're paying a rent of $2,500-$3,000, what are you going to do on the state pension of €230 a week? So, you know, we need to look at that. That needs to, there needs to be a real discussion, and it needs to happen fast, about where policy for older people are going to go. Is it going to go into your pension to supplement the private sector in terms of rent, or is it going to go into housing?
Oh, you have to, it actually brings me on to another point that I've, from some of the things I've heard you speak about, and you talked about the LDA, the Land Development Agency, and, you know, I just to give listeners an idea, this was the state's idea that they would have this, set up this, this agency that would go off to the side and, you know, 60% private and 30% affordable, 10% public, and it was going to be this kind of way of doing it, and crucial to the Fine Gael mindset, it was they wanted it off balance sheet, that they could do that. But now, I'm going to say this myself, it's my opinion, not Colette's or Martin's, but I think it was completely idiotic, because if you think you can move something off balance sheet, and yet you're saying that we're effectively subsidizing the land prices by doing this, well, then it's something that the European Commission is going to take an interest in, and all of a sudden you're not allowed to take it off balance sheet. So it was just really badly done, really badly planned, and really badly implemented. It is no one talks about it because we've got all these other things going on, but that's an unmitigated disaster. Nonetheless, the main point in that was remove the profit, something you talk about, removing the profit margin. So if you can look at a model where we have all these state lands that remove the profit model, surely then step down, to use that term, housing becomes affordable. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I mean, there are models there around affordable housing, around affordability. Like, you know, the much lauded Ó Cualann model is an example. But I mean, even outside of that, even outside of the cooperative model, the construction costs are not prohibitive. Mm. You know, this is about profit. This is about a margin. And when you talk about the LDA and you talk about the fact that they're meant to build, or they're meant to, you know, facilitate the building of 150,000 houses over the next 20 years, 10% of them are going to be social. Like, how is 60% private facilitating the type of housing policy that we need? Like, that is just pure financialization.
And I'm reminded of the O'Devany deal when we entered into something similar. Actually, if you look at the actual mechanics of the O'Devany deal, and one of the things when he turned around is said that they're going to give back a million euro towards a community centre for the locals, and you went, but you got over a million in grants to start. So it's all you're doing is actually you're not paying for anything at all. You're just returning the grant that you were given. And it worries me that is the template that this model and you know, when you see things in the programme for government between the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael parties discussing a referendum, I got all excited. And then I saw it was a referendum to cap the price of land and not actually for the right to housing. Is the right to housing, in your opinion, a much more important referendum than the one on capping the price of rent?
Yeah,
and I mean, excuse me.
Yeah, I think in terms of the right to housing, I would support that being part of the constitution. I would have initially been quite skeptical of it because I thought it shouldn't actually be required because of the way the constitution is written and how all of the rights, you know, are kind of have to be balanced with each other, and there is that kind of position in relation to the common good. So yes, you have property rights on the one side, but you also have this bigger right, this public good right. So, you know, it shouldn't be necessary. However, you know, decades upon decades of building precedent for what, you know, how protected those property rights actually are means that I think we do. And I mean, I'm no constitutional expert, but I would believe the likes of the Mercy Law Centre, and I believe, you know, the Constitutional Convention and all of the work that's gone into that. So, you know, I do think that it has become something that is necessary. So if you look at, say, other countries, like Canada brought it in last year, and it hasn't meant that, you know, like everybody gets a free gaff or anything like that. It's just about the right to have a home. Like, it's not even a right to own your own home. It's a right to be properly accommodated. And that kind of thing came up. And it's Pádraig Kenna does a lot of work on it from Galway. And that came up around the unfair terms and consumer contracts legislation at a European level. So it's Spain and Portugal, I think, have had a few cases where, you know, they've stopped local authority evictions on the basis that the state has to house somebody. So how, if there is no local authority housing, then you can't evict on the basis of, you know, this right, this need to accommodate your citizens. So the same thing would apply, presumably, if there was something along those lines in the Constitution here. Like, notwithstanding the fact that we're subject to the same unfair terms regulations, we don't use them in the same way. The courts don't use them in the same way as they did on the continent.
Yeah, we've seen cases. Sorry, Martin, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's all you mentioned precarious work. It's all interlinked. Childcare, as we've seen recently, is a huge issue, and the abandonment of childcare to the market since year dot by the government is really coming back to bite now. And that's affecting workers. It's affecting their wages, affecting their ability to pay mortgages, to their ability to rent. So how do we tackle this systematically as we ease up on the restrictions?
Well, funny you should ask that, Martin, because we have been banging the drum of a 5-point framework for exactly that reason for years. And, you know, now is the time to start really seriously talking about it from the perspective of what do we need as a social contract. So, you know, because everything is so interconnected, and as I said, there isn't any aspect of your life that isn't touched by policy. So because we have all of that, we need to look at something that takes into account having, you know, a decent economy, having a vibrant economy, but having an economy that underpins the type of society and infrastructure we need, not economy for pure profit that trickles nowhere, that actually goes into a siphon and off somewhere else. So we need to look at things like tackling, you know, low pay. We need to look at tackling poverty. Interestingly, in that framework document, there's no discussion about the eradication of poverty. You know, so we're happy enough to have a rate where, or have a society where there's 680,000 people living below the poverty line. 230,000 of them are kids. So, you know, we're looking, the first pillar would be to have a vibrant economy, but an economy that functions. And that's, you know, there's secure work, there's a decent level of income, there's a universal basic income, there's a level of services. And then going on to the next pillar would be decent services and infrastructure. So making sure we have a functioning healthcare system, you know, a good education for all that addresses educational disadvantage. Because, you know, every statistic that you look at, when you can tie it back in terms of poverty, in terms of deprivation, in terms of housing need, in terms of health, when you can go back with the CSO data to the levels of education, there is that correlation there. So, you know, we need to look at the types of services and infrastructure we have. They obviously then need to be paid for. So we need to start looking at taxes. And that's not necessarily an increase in income tax for everybody. You know, people get kind of itchy when we talk about taxation. We're talking about fairness in taxation. We're talking about just taxation. We're talking about, you know, removing some of the tax subsidies. There's a huge amount of revenue going out of the exchequer every year in the billions, like we're talking about, every single year on tax reliefs. They're not reviewed. They're not part of the budgetary process. They have no sunset clauses. So we need to start looking at those for a start. We need to start looking at an effective rate of corporation tax. We need to start looking at environmental taxes and removing some of the 4 billion in tax levies on that side. And really, you know, obviously then part of that gets wrapped up into the just transition because sustainability will be pillar 5 of what we're talking about. And that has to be done in a way that doesn't make inequalities worse, that doesn't affect, you know, people in rural Ireland that have a whole livelihood based on kind of fossil fuels or based on having to fuel a diesel car. So we need the kind of sustainability element of it, not just in terms of climate, not just in terms of environment, but also in terms of sustainability of jobs, sustainability of housing. You know, if everything is precarious, then we're just built on sand. Mm-hmm. And then, so then like the fourth pillar of that is good governance. And again, we're talking kind of transparency. We're also talking about actual real participation for people to have a say in the decisions that affect them. And to do that in a meaningful way, to have proper social dialogue, to have proper local level social dialogue so that communities can actually talk to their local government, to their elected officials and to their unelected council officials, to be able to have a discussion around the community development plans that will have an impact on how they go about their day-to-day business.
Colette, that's a really good summary. You should almost nearly wrap up at that stage, but I don't want to because I want to hold you for one more thing. I want to ask you about the idea of the scary part in Ireland is we'll say if we're going to be taxed more, can we trust them to get the services for us? That is kind of the leap of faith that's required in terms of the electorate, because the electorate vote with their wallets as well as with their minds, and often they go, well, look, I'll keep my health insurance, thank you very much, but something like a single tier health service would mean that we wouldn't have to stress as much about that, so you're better off, you're maybe paying more taxes, but you're actually better off at the end of every month. Social Justice Ireland every year does a submission on the pre-budget submission, and you put together and you cost it. It's fully costed. It's fully it's run through. Are there a couple of things that you see this year that we need to put the focus on more than ever?
I think this year's budget is going to be naturally unlike any others. I mean, it's going to be a very difficult budget to get right. But that said, you know, there were kind of murmurings yesterday in the news about a well-being budget and how that might look. And if they look to the likes of New Zealand, then, you know, they're actually thinking about the kind of stuff that we've been doing for 30 years, not me personally, but that, you know, Sean Healy, that Social Justice Ireland have been doing for the last 30 years, because as you say, we do look at a budget, we cost it, and it's costed on the basis of what's the optimal well-being across the board. So in terms of budget priorities, I think it really needs to look almost as two separate parts. So what do we need to get over where we currently are? And that's going to be an emergency spend. And then long term, what do we need? And I mean, we'd certainly advocate, and I would personally certainly advocate for investment. So we need to start driving investment in long term things, investment in housing, investment in transport, investment in roads, investment in broadband, things that have a long term impact. Yes, they are a significant budgetary hit up front. But that means then you're not constantly paying these like into billions on HAP, for example. You know, that once you get it right, the costs amortize over time. So that's the kind of, you know, we would be looking at investment, but obviously investment has to be paid for. So again, it's back to that whole thing being interrelated. There needs to be something done on the taxation side. But, you know, and people naturally, when they think of the budget and they think of taxation, they think of their own pocket, they think of their income taxes, but that's not necessarily what needs to change. What needs to change is things like site value taxes, things like environmental taxes, and the taxes that we talked about before.
I think, though, it's encouraging that at least leading into lockdown, that we acted as one in the better interests of everybody within the nation. Now, as we're coming out of lockdown, that splintering, we're seeing that there are vested interests who are making their own decisions or trying to make their own decisions. How do we hold? How do we hold that sentiment together that we act as one?
That's a big question. I think it's going to be a very difficult one. I was interested to hear Emmett Kirwan on your podcast the other night when he was talking about political discourse, and he was talking about, you know, people don't care about the kind of 10 word lines or whatever, the sound bites. They care about the policies. And I'd have to, as much as I love Emmett Kirwan, I'd have to disagree with that, because I think the media care about the sound bites and the people listen to the media. So, you know, when you look at the kind of the digital use in Ireland, we take a lot of our news from digital sources now. So if we're taking all our stuff in online, it is all soundbitey. So there needs to be, like, there should be kind of some sort of clean pledge where if we are to get out of this and not have it all splintered, then we need to think of society. We need to start looking, stop talking about welfare cheats, stop talking about, you know, notional splitters. We need to start looking at, well, actually, what kind of society do we want out of this? And in order to do that, then there absolutely has to be some level of social dialogue and social partnership to guide it so that, and here's the buzzword, all the stakeholders can actually sit around and determine for themselves and collectively what that society is going to look like.
Colette, just to sum up, I think you summed it up lovely there, but I would also like to add, stop talking about the handful of people who are getting €350 a week, who are probably getting less at the time, when that is not the real issue here. That is not the game that's at stake. And if we want to move out of this, we need to move out of it and look at it. And Martin, we've been saying this for a long time. We've been saying no going back, you know, and the reason, and the scope is there, you know, and we need, and the other argument we need to win, from my point of view, is reframing austerity. If people say that there are going to be tax increases, but we call them austerity, you can't do that because that's unfair. If you are getting more, if the public sphere increased for those tax increases, if wealth tax increases, if people saw just taxation coming into different areas, I would be happier to be down an extra couple of quid if that's what it meant, but it meant that I actually had an increased public sphere where we had a better standard of living for everybody. And it doesn't mean me having less either. It means me having a better quality of life, even if my pay packet is down a couple of quid. I think we need to win that message because austerity is being packaged as a dirty word at the moment. It's the wrong message that we're sending, and the left needs to wake up to that as well. We need to understand that if we want some of these services, they have to come from different sources. There's loads of different, you've spoken about them. You've spoken about wealth, you've spoken about corporation, you've spoken about the cutting subsidies. My God, we spend more on fossil fuel subsidies than we get from these industries. Let's get this right. Colette Bennett, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck to you guys in Social Justice Ireland. And I hope that you do manage to have your conference this year. You guys rely on donations and sponsors and members, isn't it?
Yeah, we're a membership organization. We get some grants, but also, yeah, we are a membership. So if anybody would like to join us, please log on to our website, socialjustice.ie, and come on board.
Do. And the other thing I'd say to these guys, that a lot of the talks and the papers that they produce are up there for free. They're a great resource. Take advantage of them. Look, it's,
we have a podcast now.
Yeah, and you have a great podcast now. It's just I don't like the fact that you keep introducing Mick Clifford every now and then.
Tony, we don't say great. It's doing very nicely. We wish you the very best with it for the future, definitely. Colette, thank you so much for coming on, having a chat with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.